Listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne here with you for the next half hour. On today's show, hundreds of protesters took to the streets in Montreal to demand climate action. They're asking their governments to do more.
This protest is about how angry we are about like the non-action of the government and of the big corporations. And I feel like it's very important to show that we're here and that we care because we, the young people, are going to be here the longest.
In British Columbia, a local boat builder shares his unique skills to stay in touch with his community.
Yeah, it's a good excuse to see people I haven't seen in a long time. We've been here 39 years now, but we hardly know anybody anymore. They're either left the island, gone crazy, or died. And in the third world, like places like the Philippines, they build these beautiful boats without plans, with about six tools. And they've got the picture of the boat in their heads of the how it's going to finish up. I mean, that's talent.
And through our rear view mirror, we'll take a peek at what went on across the country for Orange Shirt Day.
The generation above me, my mother and all my aunts and uncles, all went to residential school, right? And an aunt and uncle actually passed away in residential school. You know, it's got a little bit more of an important kind of impetus for me to participate in it. I still have survivors in my family that are struggling.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for keeping us company. We kick things off in Montreal, where on Friday, September 29th, hundreds of Montrealers, many of them students, took to the streets to demand climate action. Meeting at the Monument Sir Georges-Étienne Cartier, a group led by the Climate Rage Coalition, stopped traffic along major streets in the Plateau and downtown Montreal districts, dancing, marching, and calling for change. Reporter Jules Bugiel was on location and prepared this for us.
This protest is about how angry we are about like the non-action of the government and of the big corporations. And I feel like it's very important to show that we're here and that we care because we, the young people, are going to be here the longest. And it's not technically our fault because it's the past generations that did this before us. And we want a future. We want to be able to have kids and create like a world of our own. And if the planet isn't here, well, we can't do anything about it.
This is Gaëlle Raymond, a Cégep Vieux-Montréal student. She says she and her friends are doing what they can to help the environment, eating vegetarian or vegan, biking or taking public transit, and being careful about their consumption and waste. That makes it hard for them to hear that their actions aren't being met with systemic political change.
It's absolutely frustrating because we're like, why would we do this when big corporations that have a much bigger impact on the climate could do like a little action that would have so much more impact than the little things that we do as individuals?
Members of SADC, the South Asian Diaspora Action Collective, were also at Friday's march.
In South Asia, a number of like climate refugees are increasing because people are forced to move their places, migrate to other countries because their place is no longer livable. Like it's the flood and everything, their houses are washed away, their everything, they're underwater. So what are they going to do? They have to move. So those people are suffering for things that they didn't do.
Yeah.
Nuzette Niaz said she worries about her family back in Bangladesh, where flooding is becoming more extreme. Just last year, parts of the northeast of the country saw the worst floods in 100 years, displacing people in the hundreds of thousands.
I'm from South Asia, and South Asia is really, really getting like badly impacted for this climate change. Like a lot of like our lowlands are going underwater. Like the country I'm from Bangladesh, so like in 50 to 100 years, like most of the part of the country will be underwater. So that's something like that concerns us, and because I have family there, I have cousins there, like they're 1 year old, like my aunt, she's pregnant, like they will be there, and then those kids, they will grow up. What kind of future we are leaving for them?
This summer of wildfires is the first time many Quebecers are experiencing direct impacts of climate change. But SADC's Juhi Sohani says that people beyond our borders are also being affected by Canada's climate policy.
Not only are the impacts of the Canadian oil and gas industry traveling across the world in the form of smoke, but for decades they have been impacting the global south. So these islands that have gone underwater that Nuzhat is talking about, but the flooding that has been increasing year by year, Yusuf and I were just talking about that, that like my family's been talking about how the monsoon season has been getting wetter and longer each year. So people know, and people know that there's no way that the global south has been the culprit, right? Like, we're not the ones emitting. It's we, the global north, that have been emitting, and that those activities have gone unchecked. The oil and gas companies, they need to be, their emissions need to be capped, and the government has to stop giving them kickbacks for false climate solutions.
On the flip side, Sahani says we need to be attuned to how environmental harms are hitting poor and racialized communities in Montreal.
Environmental racism, people think of it as just, you know, like not just, but mining companies displacing folks and stuff like that. But environmental racism is literally right here in our homes. In Montreal Nord and Montreal Est, the life expectancy is 9 years less than in Westmount, right? In Park X, that's environmental racism, poor living conditions, and the fact that the climate crisis is going to affect those folks directly because of extreme heat, flooding, even in apartments and stuff like that, that's environmental racism. It's the same system creating that in this hyper-local context that it is in a larger context where the global north doesn't give a shit about the global south and will continue to do things until it ends up right at the doorstep of some like rich white lady in Westmount.
The climate movement is about fighting for people across the world, but also for the ones you love. Or at least that's the case for Courtney Kirkby. She says giving birth to her second child during the worst wildfire season Quebec has ever seen made her want to fight for their future.
Definitely when the hottest day came, having not been able to take my children outside, that was the first time that it really hit home for me, in a way that was kind of apocalyptic. So there was, yeah, weeks of anxiety. There also came with like a hormone crash post-birth. And I think that it was sitting with it for a while and sitting through the emotion, you know, then moving to rage, saying that no one's doing anything, nobody cares, and then kind of getting the reality check that many people in my life have been doing things for many years. So that kind of came round to gratitude, and then saying, okay, you know, come what will come, just like anything in life, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And when you have kids, I think you become acutely aware of that. So I think now I just feel action-oriented. I feel, you know, appreciate every day, every clear day that we can breathe the air, that we have livable temperatures, that we haven't been struck by some kind of catastrophe. Donate to causes and to people who are living those climate realities, and get involved, get on the street. And we decided, you know, to turn those emotions into climate action mamas.
Friday's March was an early event for the Climate Action Mamas, a group Kirkby is starting with her friend and late manifesto co-author Bianca Mugyenyi. But it's even more so for the hundreds of CEGEP and university students who came out on Friday. McGill teaching assistant Georgie Duram just moved to the city, said they were having a great time marching with Montrealers.
I think it's easy to be, you know, alone or isolated and just feeling really like angry and upset about climate, but also feeling powerless to change. But I do think that big groups of people together can really elicit a lot of change. Like even just looking like at us here on Park, which is usually a huge road full of cars and there's no traffic right now. And that in itself is a really big deal. I also think that it's great to involve organizers of all levels and experiences. You know, there might be some organizers who have, this is like the 50th protest they've ever organized, or they know how to contact government and like participate in public government. And there might be people, you know, like me who are new to Montreal and are just looking to get involved, and we can all learn from each other as how to actually go about navigating what can be really complicated political systems to enact change.
The protesters were clear, no matter how difficult it is, those systems will need to change to keep up with the catastrophic effects of climate change. Here's Juhi Sohani again.
Now
now, right, there's the opportunity for the Liberal government to cap oil and gas emissions and to invest in renewables, and they're probably just going to find a whole bunch of loopholes, or they're going to use it as a way to get reelected, and so they just keep kicking the can down the road. But what they really need to do is they need to take meaningful climate action. Also, just to know that, like, investing in renewables will create over twice the jobs, and that there'll be safer jobs, better jobs. It's going to have less strain on our healthcare system, on our housing.
The marchers were just as clear about what's facing the opponents to climate action. Brebeuf College student Mila Bashour says it's those opponents who keep her fighting.
One of the reasons why I'm still out here today to show that there's hundreds and thousands of people that still give a shit about this cause and how it's super important that we still need to be out here despite all of these big corporations and people prioritizing profit that don't care about it enough, that there's a whole generation that's out here that's going to take them down.
I'm Jules Bijel. Thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Hello, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints. We now turn to Ontario, where the Wellington Food Bank says demand has drastically increased over the past 2 years. This as the poverty report card from Food Banks Canada gave Ontario an overall grade of D, and the province got a C- in food security. Over 43% of the people surveyed say that they're feeling worse off financially than last year. Almost 38% are spending more than a third of their income on housing, and 30% are having trouble accessing health care. This provincial issue is taking form in many communities, including Centre Wellington. More on this with Riley Gillespie-Wilson in Fergus, Ontario.
Centre Wellington Food Bank Management say they've seen a rapid climb in the number of new households and families utilizing their resources. Jackie Andrews, chair of the board of directors, reports 167 families were using the food bank in August of 2021. The most recent figure, August of this year, shows 242 families required assistance. Andrews provided more context, stating a lot more families aren't just using the food bank once a month.
Of that 242 families that use the food bank, we had 328 households using it altogether. So almost 100 of those families came more than once during the month of August.
Manager Kurt McQueen says there are a few factors contributing to this, and added it's not necessarily a bad trend.
One of our main goals is to continue to reduce the stigma of food bank use. So I think, and I'm hoping that our numbers have gone up a bit, actually, because people out there who should have already been accessing our supports and services are now taking that step in the door.
Both Andrews and McQueen went on to thank the community of Centre Wellington for their unparalleled generosity. I'm Riley Gillespie-Wilson.
You're tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
And on our radar, we go back to the Truth and Reconciliation weekend of September 30th. The day is also known as Orange Shirt Day, which commemorates the tragic history and impacts of the residential school system and honors reconciliation. In the Edmonton region, there were plenty of events happening on that day. In Devon, for example, a small town about 26 kilometers southeast of Edmonton, a ceremony of storytelling, reflection, and remembrance was held. To mark the day, Devon Healing Medicine Grounds, which is located along River Drive, opened up to the public so Indigenous people in the area have a place to feel safe and heal. Mike Hanley, a town councillor for the town of Devon, spoke to Ryan Hunt about what the day really means. Ryan Hunt also spoke with Lloyd Cardinal, a community volunteer who helped with smudges. He also sang honor songs for the children who never returned from the residential school system.
Today is a gathering for truth and reconciliation, and that's the wording that we use, but I actually believe truth then reconciliation. So there's a lot of sharing going on today, and the first thing that we're sharing is the truth, and we need to know the history of what's happened to divide Canadians, create misunderstanding, and to create trauma that's impacting our lives on a daily basis. Understanding the legacy of residential schools, the past system, and how that's resulted in something that's hurting the lives of all Canadians is something that every single person in Canada can relate to right now. The National Day for Truth and Reconciliation has obviously got a very somber undertone. A lot of the truths aren't happy truths that we're here to celebrate, but the fact that we're out here together acknowledging them is something we need to celebrate. So there's that really two sides to this whole thing.
To me, today is like an act of reconciliation. It's also an acknowledgement, and we're basically just coming together as people of the land and everyone to just honor the children that didn't make it home from residential schools, and also to honor the children that are being found even to this day.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
In Peterborough, Ontario, it has been a busy month for James Oxen and Samantha Shaw, the owners of the Peterborough-based t-shirt and print shop, Nish Tees. Orange Shirt Day is being one of Nish Tees' busiest business days. Nish Tees uses traditional Anishinaabe teaching in the design of their orange shirts. Last year, they sold about 5,000 shirts and donated $7,000 to TRAX, a land-based youth program that braids multiple scientific ways of knowing and being by centering Indigenous sciences. This year, Nish Tees will be donating funds to NatWin, a local effort working to provide essential goods and services to northern communities. Here's Edward Sweeney speaking with owners James Hogson and Samantha Shaw.
I'm Indigenous. My people are from White Sand First Nation, which is north of Lake Superior, the northwest shore of Lake Nipigon. The generation above me, my mother and all my aunts and uncles, all went to residential school, right? And an aunt and uncle actually passed away in residential school. You know, it's got a little bit more of an important kind of impetus for me to participate in it, because I still have survivors in my family that are struggling.
You also wanted to support Indigenous organizations, and we've been able to fundraise with the sales of the orange shirts, and we've been able to donate a lot of money over the years, mm-hmm. which has helped various community organizations, Indigenous community organizations. I mean, it's fluctuated a bit, but we've been able to donate, you know, since the kind of rise in awareness, we've been able to donate between $7,000 and $13,000 with our fundraiser to different organizations.
And in Kootenay, British Columbia, the Selkirk College received a $5,000 donation to support Indigenous students. The donation was from the Grant Thornton office in Castlegar. The money will be used to support Indigenous students at the college through Selkirk's Giving Day Fund. Here's Andrew Jopp, Manager of Advancement and Alumni Relations at Selkirk College, speaking to Scott Anishak.
We're absolutely delighted to have received the donation from Grant Thornton's branch in Castlegar. The money is going to support Indigenous students at the college, and quite often those Indigenous students face higher costs of following their higher education dreams and journeys. This money is actually going to be directed more towards emergency funding. Just having these extra supports and funds available can make a really big difference.
Just a reminder that many of our journalists also covered lots of stories for the Day of Truth and Reconciliation. Take a peek at what went on at canada-info.ca.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
In British Columbia, a boat builder shares his unique skills with his community. Pierre Belcourt and his partner Thérèse Belcourt have been living on Cortes Island off the BC coast for almost 40 years, but this month is the first time that they have attended the Friday market. Belcourt is a boat builder, but he has worked as a carpenter for movie sets like X-Men 3, Tron 2, Paycheck, and The Watchmen. He has built custom homes like a German-style home home with the local artist builder Volker Steigman, but his most extensive work with his hands has been boat building. He has, for example, rebuilt a Baltic sloop. He has crafted dory skiffs and a 30-foot wooden oyster boat. Tools are very important in Belcour's line of work. He had a wide assortment of tools on hand at the Cortes Island Friday Market. Several market goers approached Belcour, while journalist Lonnie Taylor observed most with a variety of tools with dull edges in hand. Belcour says he's happy to sharpen just about anything. It's a good excuse to see people I haven't seen in a long time, Pierre said.
We've been here 39 years now, but we hardly know anybody anymore. They're either left the island, gone crazy, or died. Yes, seriously.
So, 39 years. So, I mean, have you ever offered anything at the market in the past?
Never, no.
And what is it that you usually do as a trade on Cortes? Or
I build boats and houses and cabins, and I worked in film for 11, 12 years as a scenic carpenter, building sets. Yeah, it was fun, but it was getting time to call it a day when I did finally leave.
Cool. Okay, so you have a carpentry background, and that's where your skill in sharpening comes from?
In boat building a long time ago, when I started boat building, you have to keep your chisels and planes, draw shaves, adz, all those things sharp to cut wood, you know, to slice wood, not to butcher it.
So the tools and the maintenance of the tools is really key to your craft as a boat maker.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Beautiful.
It less now. Now there's a lot of machine is used, where we used to use, you know, hand tools to make things. The Scottish boat builders, they up in Scotland, they used to put a penny, the English copper penny, on the toenail, and then they would take an adz, a razor sharp adz, and knock the penny off the toenail, presumably without slicing the toe.
For what purpose?
Because they got so accurate with adzes, they could shape boat ribs, planks, even a deck of a ship with an adz. Well, nowadays we use grinders and hand planers, electric planers, and all kinds of machinery to do these things, table saws, chop saws, band saws. They used to do all that stuff by hand. So hand saws, planes, chisels. And in the third world, like places like the Philippines, they build these beautiful boats without plans, with about six tools, a little hand adz. And they've got the picture of the boat in their heads of how it's going to finish up. No plans, no paper plans. I mean, that's talent, you know. And you know, it's the Vikings that taught the Scots and the Irish how to build lap-strake boats.
I'm really glad you took it to the Vikings, because as you were describing, you know, envisioning the boat, I was thinking of Floki from Vikings.
Right.
From the show, so.
Floki?
Floki.
Oh, Floki.
Floki the boat builder from Vikings.
Yes.
It's from the History Channel, the Viking show.
So it's very interesting, because, some of them did stay and teach the Scots and the Irish, for example, their skills of boat building. They didn't just rape, pillage, and leave places. I mean, they did a lot of that, for sure, but...
Right. Well, and we know now, at least the most recent evidence shows that the first boats from the Eastern world were Vikings.
Like Vikings about 1,000 years ago.
So
yeah, not...
Very relevant. And so you carry on that tradition, but you're using some modern tools for your sharpening now. What is it that you use to sharpen your tools
mostly,
that you brought with here?
Grinder. I use diamonds.
Okay, so have an electric grinder, and then you have some hand tools, some diamonds as well.
Yeah, I don't use oil stones or water stones anymore. I use diamonds, diamond impregnated plates. These are all diamonds, 400 grit, 1,000 grit, 600 grit. Yeah.
Awesome.
Are you taking film too, or just sound?
No, just sound, and okay. I can hear you knocking those things against each other, so it's really good. Cool. Okay, so are you also at the Saturday markets in the Gorge?
I was going to, and then our son...
Oh, that market's not happening anymore.
That's
okay.
Right.
Well,
luckily,
that's good to know.
Our son texted me and said, no, it's already over, the Saturday thing at the Gorge.
Okay. Okay, so you'll be back here on Fridays,
Friday.
Noon to 3 o'clock is when the Friday market goes. here at Manson's Hall.
Next week for sure. But maybe for the week coming. It depends, you know.
It depends how good the turnout is.
Yeah.
So if you want to get your tools sharpened, now is the time. Friday market,
sure.
Noon to,
yeah,
to
yeah,
3
yeah.
p.m.
Next couple
here
of weeks.
Here at Belcourt's out in front of the post office. Sharpening pretty much just anything. This is great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Lonnie Taylor.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, British Columbia. You are listening to Viewpoints.
And to close the show, we'll be rolling up our sleeves, and you guessed why. As the fall season sets in, and yes, the winter is also closing in on us, the updated COVID-19 and flu vaccination campaigns are being deployed across the country. Last week, the province of Nova Scotia laid down its plans. They are similar to those announced in other Canadian provinces and territories. Nova Scotia Chief Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Robert Strang, provided details about the vaccination campaign rollout at a press conference on October 3rd. Here's Ed Alverson with the details.
Nova Scotia has announced the availability of new COVID-19 and influenza vaccines. Chief Medical Officer of Health Dr. Robert Strang provided details about the rollout at a press conference Tuesday. Nova Scotians aged 65 and older can get the high-dose influenza vaccine now. All Nova Scotians will have access to Moderna's updated COVID-19 vaccine during the week of October 16th. The standard dose influenza vaccine is arriving in the province the week of October 23rd, and Pfizer's updated COVID-19 vaccine will be available sometime in late October or early November. The high-dose flu vaccine will be available at local pharmacies and medical clinics across the province starting this week. Strang emphasized the importance of vaccination, stating, quote, "This fall, we encourage everyone to roll up their sleeves and get both recommended vaccines to protect their health. It's the best way to limit the spread of both influenza and COVID-19, end quote. The province is advising Nova Scotians that they can receive both flu and COVID vaccines at the same time. Anyone wishing to receive a vaccine can do so at a nearby pharmacy or outreach clinic by signing up online. Alternatively, people can book their shots through their family doctors or nurse practitioners. Nova Scotia Health is reminding people that vaccines do not cause influenza or COVID-19 and that symptoms for both illnesses can overlap, including fever, headache, and fatigue. Anyone who has already received their primary series of COVID-19 vaccines are eligible for an updated dose if 6 months have passed since their last vaccination or known COVID-19 infection. And officials are recommending children aged 6 months to 9 years should receive 2 doses of the influenza vaccine 4 weeks apart this fall if they have never been vaccinated before. Health authorities are urging all Nova Scotians to prioritize their health by getting vaccinated against both influenza and COVID-19 to protect themselves, their loved ones, and their communities. I'm Ed Halverson.
And that's it for us this week. Thanks to our journalists Lonnie Taylor, Ed Alverson, Jules Bugiel, Riley Gillespie-Wilson, Ryan Hunt, Edward Sweeney, and Scott Anishuk. Our national editors Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassin. Thanks for being here. Stay tuned to the show that follows. Take care. Ciao.
Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.